Succession number 12139, Reel 2.
General Green in Reel 2.
Well, one does not easily forget the march we did from Louvain through Brussels. We were pretty tired, naturally, although we had had some bits of sleep, but we had a march then of somewhere between 25 and 30 miles. And funnily enough, one of the things that one had to stop was the people of Brussels were amazed to see us marching, apparently, the wrong way. They were obviously sort of feeling not only sorry for themselves, but sorry for us. And they were trying to get our people to drink glasses of beer all along the route. Well, it was all very well, the soldiers drinking sort of the odd glass of beer, but not too many. And I had to actually go and tell some of these good people, for goodness sake, please stop giving my soldiers beer, because otherwise they won't be able to march and they won't be able to fight. And I think they took the lesson. And on we went. And I'm not it wasn't on this march, it was on another one that we started being able to get some transport. But the sequence of the Dunkirk campaign was much the same each time. You withdrew from your position, you marched, or moved one way and the other to a new position where your commanding officer told you where you were to go. You then dug in as quick as you possibly could, and usually before you dug in properly, the enemy had arrived. And so you then had to fight sort of in only a half-dug-in position. And this, usually our position was along a river or along some feature which was reasonably defensible. At around this stage, one of the company commanders was wounded, and I was then told to go and command a company, one of the other companies. And they were all sort of new chaps that I did know a lot of them because we'd been in Palestine together only a year or two back. So they weren't strangers at all. But anyway, I went and commanded a company, knowing extremely little about how to command a company. But one learns fairly quickly when you step into either dead men's shoes or wounded men's shoes. And I got the sort of sequence of how these things happened, and even that 2 or 3 days in Louvain had given one a good bit of experience about what not to do, even if you didn't know enough about what to do. And I think we gave the Germans a very good run for their money. And each time when they attacked, our rifle shooting and our light machine gun shooting was so good that I think that the Germans really were very surprised. And there was a sort of halt for about 24 hours until they received reinforcements or extra artillery or something or other, and they had another go. And the same thing would happen again. And my impression was that they were getting a lot more casualties than we did, because our companies had started about, say, 100 strong, that sort of figure. And by the end, every company had still got, say, about 50 people left. And so the sequence went on, withdraw, dig in, defend, withdraw, etc., until we got, or let me say, there were just one or two little incidents in these withdrawing. One day, up in the sort of Ypres area, really, we had to do a daylight withdrawal. I think this had happened because of the rapid advance of the Germans to the south, and that if we hadn't withdrawn then, we might have been enveloped. But anyway, we had to do a daylight withdrawal. And again, the recollection was, finally, when we were withdrawing, very flat country, and we were withdrawing through fields of corn, and we were crouched down, crawling through the fields of corn so that we couldn't be seen, because the enemy had got positions where they could have seen us if we'd been standing up. And I noticed once when I just sort of lay down for a little bit of rest for a minute or two, lying on my back and watching the corn stalks being cut off by bullets firing from the enemy. It's funny how little things like that stick in one's mind. We were, on that occasion, we had marvelous support from our carrier platoons. We had this vehicle called a carrier, which was a small tracked vehicle which simply carried one light machine gun, but they were quite mobile, and unless the enemy had anti-tank weapons available, they were reasonably safe from small arms fire. And our carrier platoon covered our withdrawal extremely well. Other things that caught one's imagination was an unfortunate one of our motorcyclists. The motorcyclists were usually members of the signal platoon, and they supplemented the telephone and such radio links as there were by riding their motorcycles around and actually carrying messages. And one of these places we got to, we warned this chap, don't ride between that place and that place. There's a gap, and there's a chap who has got that place covered. One of the enemy has got it covered, and he shoots at anybody who goes down there. Unfortunately, this unfortunate chap didn't take our advice. He put his foot down and tried to go across the gap at about 100 miles an hour, but he got shot just the same, which was again, one of these little things that you remember sort of seeing and how unfortunate it was. Well, the sequence was rather repeated itself until the last bit, and that was we had to motor round behind our own lines. Now, to try and explain it, I didn't understand why we did this until long after the war, when I read what had been happening. And that was that the German army had got right round the right flank of the British army and was going for the Channel ports and to envelop us. And the only hope for the British army was to shorten its line on the right and swing round in order to make a place round the port of Dunkirk, which we could defend until we evacuated ourselves. Now, we happened to be the at that stage the right-hand division of the BEF. And so we then started to curl our right flank back, and that meant transferring gradually a unit or a brigade to motor behind our own lines, away on to the north, and then join up at the left of the line, which had been also left vacant because the Belgians had surrendered. And so we had to do this in order to close the gap between the sea and the left of the British line. At the same time, curling back until we had a sort of moon-shaped crescent with each flank on the sea. And we couldn't understand that night when we were motoring along that instead of getting away from the shelling and away from the enemy, we seemed to be going parallel with it and going along, and each crossroads we came to was under fire. And we couldn't understand why we weren't getting back the, like we'd been doing for the last 2 or 3 weeks, away from the enemy. And this actually was the reason, but we didn't understand it at the time. The one thing I would really like to mention here is that the British Army very often has a suspicion or a dislike, or whatever you like to call it, of the military police, the Royal Military Police. And they think that they handle them rather too strictly in times of peace. Well, I can only tell you that one had the most tremendous admiration for them in time of war, because on this particular occasion, at every one of those crossroads, which the Germans knew were being used and were important to us, there was a military policeman in his white gloves and his red hat, just exactly as if he was on duty in London or somewhere, motioning the traffic. And he had, and this was in the middle of the night, he had a fair idea of how many shells were going to come from the Germans in the next minute or two, and he had a fairly good idea of whether there was going to be a gap of a minute or two when the no shells would come. So he would motion the traffic to go through when he reckoned that there was a safe period, and then he'd stop it when he reckoned that there's bound to be a shell or two in the next minute or two. And he kept on doing that, and you could see that there had been casualties, and indeed on one of these places we heard that the previous man on point duty had been killed a moment or two before, and a new chap had got out of a slit trench and had taken his place. And my admiration for the Royal Military Police, I've never forgotten that sort of incident all down the way. Well, then we got to our last real position before getting into this crescent around Dunkirk, and that was in the middle of water meadows and with a canal in front of us, and that was reasonably safe. We did get attacked, but nothing to count. But about that time, we really were feeling extremely tired. And I remember in the middle of the night, my second-in-command coming round to have a look at us and see whether we were all right. And when somebody woke me up to say, second-in-command's coming, sir, I got up. It took me about a minute to be able to actually properly stand up. I kind of staggered around as if I was drunk until I sort of managed to realized that I was awake, and then I was reasonably normal again. Well, then the next night, which was the it must have been the last day of May. We got orders to withdraw in the usual fashion and go to the beach. And the way we went through was through a little town which then was called La Panne. And it was being very heavily shelled by the Germans, and there were an awful lot of wounded and dead around. And my particular memory of that place was, which was almost as bright as day because so many houses were burning, so you could see what was going on. A wounded man hitched himself up on one elbow and motioned to me as if to say, could I come and have a word? And so I went over, and I could see that he was very near dead. And he sort of whispered to me and said, "Are you an officer?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Leave to fall out, sir, please." Well, there's not much you can say to that. And I tried to get a stretcher bearer, but he was dead a minute or two later. But that's the sort of spirit which keeps people going. And then we got out. As I say, I'd still got about sort of 50 of my chaps around, and they were pretty sort of seasoned by that time too. And we got onto the beach at La Panne, and on the beach I saw that the engineers and the Royal Army Service Corps, as they were then, had made a series of sort of piers into the sea by driving three-ton or big trucks into the sea at low tide, putting duckboarding along the top and using them as piers for the small boats to come in and take people off. And so we thought, well, all right, we'd better do it this way too. And so we lined up by one of these piers, and in fact, a lot of us sat on the top of the piers waiting for something to happen. I've got a photograph of our commanding officer and several of us sitting on the top of one of these piers, waiting and hoping for a boat to come along. Well, having waited for quite a long time, nothing happened. No boats came in. There was quite a lot of heavy bombing by the Germans, and we saw sort of several ships sunk while we were there. And the whole coast, the beach, was covered in sort of bits and pieces of belongings and rubble and equipment and goodness knows what, and several ships were sort of grounded along the beach, which had been sunk and just had grounded themselves there. And so the commanding officer, Colonel Fergus Knox, who was a marvellous commanding officer during that that campaign, he said, "Right, get the companies onto the beach, and we will march down to Dunkirk," which was about I think about 6 or 7 miles down the beach. Well, we did that, and also he gave orders that nobody is to get on a boat unless he has at least a rifle or a light machine gun. And if possible, it would be nice if we brought back some of our anti-tank rifles, which weren't much use, actually, but we thought that they were at that time. And so we did that, and we marched down to the beach, and you saw the most extraordinary sights going on. You saw a little bunch of British soldiers sitting on the sand as if they were at a holiday resort in England or somewhere, playing cards or drinking tea, while Messerschmitts were flying up and down the beach, and you could see the bullets hitting the beach one after another, going down the beach. And these soldiers are looking and saying, well, he doesn't seem to be able to shoot very straight, does he? When these bullets were perhaps sort of 3 or 4 yards to one side of them. And there were marvellous scenes like that. On the other hand, there were some unpleasant happenings which meant that boats, for instance, which had been reserved for the wounded being taken out to bigger boats, were seized by little gangs of people who had lost their nerve a bit and reckoned that they were going to pinch any boat. But by and large, the astonishing sort of business as usual attitude of the British soldier held the day, as you might say. When we got down to the mole at Dunkirk, and the commanding officer had said, I understand that there is a boat there which could take most of us, if not all of us. We saw moored alongside the mole, and mind you, the ship was rocking to and fro most of the time because there were bombs dropping in the harbour. We started getting on board. There was a dead man lying across the gangplank, and we stepped over him fairly gingerly, and I gradually managed to get my company sort of into little corners and sitting down somewhere, and got them reasonably comfortable. And then I sat down myself somewhere in a corner. And after a little time, I saw incidentally, this was an Isle of Man paddle steamer called the Ben McCree. When I saw it first, I thought to myself, I don't know how on earth it's got here, and I doubt if it'll be able to get back. It didn't look terribly sort of seaworthy. However, it did get back. But after I'd been sitting in what was probably one of the saloons or something in this ship, I saw a man in a white coat walking about and sort of stepping over all these myriad people who were sitting or lying there. And I thought to myself, I wonder if this is possibly by any chance a steward. And I beckoned him, and I said, excuse me, but are you a steward? And he said, yes, sir, can I do anything for you? And I said, well, would it be possible for you to produce a glass of beer for me? Or if you can't produce a glass of beer, a glass of water? And he said, oh, yes, sir, by all means. But, of course, you do know the rules that I can't supply you with any alcohol till we're 3 miles out. I thought to myself, we can't lose the war with people like this around. However, he was as good as his word, and by the time that happened, I'd remembered myself, and I thought, well, I must get him to sort of see if he can give the soldier something too. So we all got something eventually. But I thought this business as usual attitude is, in fact, one of the hallmarks of a reasonable soldier. And this chap was simply a steward in a ship.
Did you have to pay for it?
Do you know, I can't remember that, but I doubt it. I think he probably he probably reckoned that this was a slightly unusual situation. But we got back. We don't remember much. I think we just slept. I suppose if the boat had been sinking, we would have probably realized and we'd have woken up. We arrived the other end at Dover, and the only thing I remember after that was waking up in a train at a place called Headcorn in Kent, where the women of Headcorn almost, you might say, gave us a party. They all invaded the train tea, coffee, buns, and all sorts of things, and greeted us almost as if we were a victorious army. And this really rather embarrassed us. We felt, but damn it, we've run away. But anyway, they were absolutely marvellous and made us feel that things were more or less normal again. And the next time I woke up was on Tweezledown Racecourse near Aldershot, where I was told I'd slept for 16 hours in a tent. The only other thing in that aspect that I did was I'd forgotten that the uppers of one of my boots was flapping so that my toes were showing, but I'd got so used to this that I didn't sort of notice it much. And I realized that my brother was at the staff college at Camberley, not so far away. I had already managed to ring my mother and father, who naturally had been fairly anxious, to say I was sort of back in the UK anyway. But I thought I must go and visit my brother, who was a student on the staff at Camberley, a student at Camberley. And as I went and saw him, and they all looked at me aghast, as if to say, how can you possibly visit us looking like you do? Because I hadn't sort of taken my clothes off or anything. I just thought, well, we haven't taken our clothes off much for the last sort of fortnight or so. I probably smelt, I should think, rather nasty. But anyway, they gave me a bath, which was rather nice. And I think they gave me a pair of boots, too, at Sandhurst. But that was what might call, as far as I was concerned, the end of the Dunkirk campaign. And then we all... we.